You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Romillo, credentialed writer and reporter and the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. The Miami Heat played their second seeding game with the NBA restart Monday afternoon against the Toronto Raptors. And after being down as many as 17 points, they clawed their way back to take the lead, but eventually some bad shots and even worse officiating, as well as a career-high 36 points from Fred VanVleet, were just too much to overcome for the Heat. I'll give you my takeaways from the game, answer some of your questions, and give you the good, the bad, and the ugly from the 107-103 loss. The big story of the game is the actual comeback. Miami started the same lineup they did in the previous game against the Denver Nuggets with Myers Leonard on the bench and Jay Crowder in the starting lineup. I was a little surprised at that considering they have a game on Tuesday afternoon against the Boston Celtics. I thought they'd want to keep those legs a little fresh and want to give Bam a little bit more of a break there, give Jay a little bit more of a break and have him come off the bench as he has for most of the season. Instead, Spo elects to go with Crowder again. Overall, the point is that Miami really struggled in that first half. They were really, really bad, particularly on their shooting front. Their offense was just bogged down constantly. I know Toronto's defense is very good. They are one of the better defensive teams in the league alongside the Milwaukee Bucks and others, but they have a system where they give up a lot of three-point attempts by design. This is what their goals are, similar to what Miami does. They give up a lot of three-pointers. They focus on closing out. They focus on challenging all those shots, but at the same time, they'll give up a lot of three-point shots knowing that they can continue to get people to take bad shots at the rim or have them kick it out to the perimeter and then put up a rush shot. Unfortunately for Miami, a lot of the shots they gave up were pretty wide open, and they just weren't knocking those down. And that's from everybody in that starting lineup. There were a number of players that struggled. I'll get into that in the next segment, but they shot just 5 of 23 in the first half from three-point line. That's pretty horrific. And then somehow they were able to kind of chip away at it. They tightened their defense a little bit. They focused on limiting some touches from Kyle Lowry, who was mostly playmaking. He didn't have a huge game. A lot of that offense fell on Fred VanVleet's shoulders, but they also limited what Siakam was doing. Pascal Siakam had 15 points in the first half, if I'm not mistaken, and finished with just 22 points in the whole game. So he didn't have a huge game, and of course, in the second half, but Miami was really able to tighten their defense on him in particular, and they just started slowly coming back in the third quarter. And again, they finished 14 of 45 from three-point range. Good for 31%. Not great, but considering the fact that they started off 5 of 23, they were able to knock down 9 of the remaining 22 shots. So not a bad percentage overall in that second half. The first half was really, really ugly, and at least Miami was able to stay in it. I thought it was going to be a wash. I thought they were just going to get completely scrubbed out in the second half, and somehow Miami proved me wrong. They stayed resilient. They got some key contributions from a number of players, and they looked really impressive in the second half. I don't feel too bad about the loss. I think a lot of you feel the same way. Having seen what happened, you can chalk it up to VanVleet's performance, some bad calls, which I'll get into a little later, and some other bad performances from some key players. But at the same time, what really matters is that Miami didn't give up. And you could easily look at this game as a seeding game and just say, you know what, it's not really matter. It doesn't really matter. Miami's in the playoffs regardless. You don't have anything to prove against the Raptors. But they were able to kind of just focus on what they needed to do. They tightened it up a little bit, and they really just seemed to make a concerted effort to get very good. I for a while there, did not expect them to come back, and when they did, I half expected them to win the game. They looked that impressive, and then just things kind of caught up and evened up there, to regress to the mean, if you will. And somehow, I think it doesn't really matter because the resilience is what really stood out to me, that Miami's was willing to just kind of stay in the game, to focus on everything that matters and to compete at a high level. And I think even players after the game didn't hang their heads as much as they normally would. So it's interesting, again, considering it's the first game of a back-to-back set, you have to have a strong showing on Tuesday against Boston before wrapping up for a matchup against the Milwaukee Bucks on Thursday. You certainly don't want to lose two straight before facing the Bucks, who will have something to prove against the Miami Heat. Certainly don't want to lose three straight. Something that, to keep in mind because Miami is hanging on to that fourth seed in the Eastern Conference standings. But if there was one player who was probably most responsible for Miami's comeback, I'd have to give credit to Goran Dragic, and he's the little story of the game. He was phenomenal. 9 of 14 from the floor, finished with 25 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists, and 2 steals. probably one of the most complete games of the season. I actually tweeted out that I thought his defense looked really sharp in the first half. He was making a number of key plays there. He looked energetic. I'm not sure if it's the bubble. I'm not sure if it's the lack of distractions. Maybe he's just healthy. Maybe he hasn't been practicing as much as he had during the regular season. But he looks really, really engaged, energetic. And I think he's just going to continue to be a key contributor for Miami, one that they're going to rely on quite a bit. And so that's a good thing and a bad thing if he doesn't wind up being able to produce as much as he is. But Dragic had a really, really good game, was aggressive, intercepted a pass there and was able to take it, you know, court to court. He looked good. Look, I know he was responsible for at least one of the key turnovers late in the game, but I don't think it was entirely his fault. It was a pass that he made to Jimmy Butler. And if you look back at the replay, I personally thought that Butler's arm was being held by Kyle Lowry, who was defending Butler at that time. Butler was crossing over through the paint and through the baseline, along the baseline, and he was actually being held by Lowry as he tried to intercept the pass from Goron. It was charged to Goron as far as the turnover is concerned, but in reality, I think it was just a matter of Butler's timing being maybe slightly off and probably being impacted by Lowry holding his arm in that play. But that's a whole other story. Just good overall game from Goron. And I'm curious to see what happens on Tuesday, because he has not been a particularly great player on the second night of back-to-backs. You don't want to continue to push him in this, you know, intense a level here. So I wonder if he's going to continue to get as many minutes as he did against Toronto, because he did play 28 minutes against the Raptors. And so I don't know if he can match that kind of workload on back-to-back nights, considering his injuries, his age, and everything else. So additional takeaways from the game. I got to say, Kelly Olynyk continues to impress. I just like the rhythm of which Olynyk is playing. I know there's a lot to it. He wasn't sharp in the first half against the Denver Nuggets and then wound up having that 20-point explosion in the fourth quarter. In the game against the Raptors, he played 31 minutes, almost as much as Bam Adebayo, almost as many as Jimmy Butler. So he's getting the bulk of the playing time, even more than Goran Dragic and more than a couple of starters there. Olynyk was just a valued weapon for Eric Spoelstra off the bench. He finished 6 of 13 from the floor, 4 of 11 from three-point range, and finished with 17 overall points. He's a plus impact player out there, and I think that's the biggest thing, especially on the defensive end. He wasn't a problem. He was able to contain or at least stay with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or Serge Ibaka when they were in the game. He was able to compete against Marcus Saul or Pascal Siakam. So it wasn't a concern for Spoelstra to leave Olynyk out there for as long as he was. And moreover, offensively, he just seems to be in a really, really good groove. I think this is the best version of Kelly that we've seen offensively, where he's just really leaned into his three-point shooting. He continues to keep defenses on their toes by using the dribble handoff as effectively as he has. He's able to get to the rim on occasion. Obviously, he still has a pretty good handle for a seven-footer, but it just seems like his shooting, you look at it, the way he just kind of takes a dribble, step back three, and just that looks like a wing type player, a smaller shooter, or maybe even a guy like, you know, a Kevin Durant, who feels comfortable being that kind of a scorer. I know the comparison seems a little ludicrous, you know, Durant being one of the best scorers in NBA history, but I have to say, Olynyk's comfort as a shooter has really taken a huge leap this season, and it's something to continue to watch as whether or not he's able to stay consistent with this. That was one of my points from after the Denver Nuggets game, is that I was worried whether or not he would continue to be as effective and consistent as a shooter. He proved that today against the Raptors. Duncan Robinson was taken out of the game a little completely by the Raptors, and I think that's a key point to make, is that they're going to focus on him, and that was a point that I was concerned with and when I was previewing the Raptors game, is that I thought OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, and others were going to be able to challenge Duncan. He did not have a lot of space. He only played 22 minutes, finished 1 of 5 from the floor, 1 three-point attempt, obviously 1 of 4 from the three-point line, and didn't really have much of an impact other than that. Wasn't able to make any kind of key passes, pulled down a couple of rebounds, but just not really much of a factor. And you have to give Toronto's defense credit for that, because they really took Duncan out of the game completely. And Miami still found a way to get other players going. And so if that's going to be Olynyk, either way, I think Robinson has a positive impact where he's making, it might not be a productive one on the stat sheet, but if you're focused on him, from a defensive perspective, then you're going to at least allow some open shots for others. And they were able to take away Duncan. They give up those shots to Kelly Olynyk or Jay Crowder, who also finished with 10 three-point attempts. So between Crowder and Olynyk, they finished with 21 three-point attempts and finished 8 of 21. So not great, perhaps, but not terrible either. And I think that's by design from the Raptors as well. And then the officiating is my third takeaway from the game. The flagrants. A flagrant foul was assessed to Goran Dragic and to Kelly Olynyk. Goran, in particular, put up a shot. I think it was blocked by Ogene Anunoby, and then he fell to the floor and grabbed Anunoby's leg there. It was deemed that it wasn't a foul, as far as he wasn't trying to instill any pain, but he was actively grabbing Anunoby's head leg there. So I think they charged him the flagrant. Kind of silly, to be honest with you. It didn't seem like all that egregious a foul. And Olynyk's foul call, whew, that was horrific, because it seemed like he was swiping to get the ball out of Kyle Lowry's hand. Who Lowry, man, I gotta tell you, it's hard watching him sometimes. I love a lot of what Kyle Lowry can do, but the flopping just gets to me. And I'm not a big fan. I think he sells contact so completely. He complains a lot for fouls. I know that's competitive. I know that's an edge that players need. But it just, sometimes you don't like to see it, particularly as from covering a team that's opposing Kyle Lowry in a specific game like this. Anyway, Olynyk swiped at the ball, and it looked like he may or may not have made contact with Lowry's face. I personally didn't even see it. Lowry sold it as if he was shot from the third row or something like that. It looks horrific. And he fell to the floor, crumpling to the floor, hitting the floor with his hand, and then he was charged, and Olynyk was charged with a flagrant. And then after the game, officials actually said that probably shouldn't have called it a flagrant. And again, then to have Kyle Lowry grab Jimmy Butler's arm during a key possession late in the game, probably not such a good look. So the officiating was not great. The Heat only shot 16 free throws, converting on 15 of them. Goran unfortunately missed a key free throw down the stretch there. Not that it really mattered ultimately, but they did finish 15 of 16 from the line. Conversely, the Raptors shot 36 free throw attempts. I think a lot of that had to do with them getting to the rim and not relying on the three-point shot as much as Miami did. But either way, not a great look. The officiating was not great. I never like to blame them, but I think they were a little off. And it's interesting. If Miami matches up with the Raptors in a playoff series, that should be a very tightly contested one, a really good, fun series. And hopefully those foul calls won't always go Lowry's way, as they did on Monday. In the next segment, I'll go through the good, the bad, and the ugly before I answer your questions about today's game. But everyone needs support to make it through the day. It doesn't matter if you're a professional athlete, a stay-at-home parent like I am, or if you spend 8 hours a day in an uncomfortable office chair. You need that support, and our friends at CBDMD have an amazing duo that can help you relax, regroup, and recharge when life gets chaotic. CBD Freeze with Menthol is an award-winning product that offers instant cooling relief. It feels so good on your muscles and joints. It's convenient, easy to use in a roller or on a shareable squeeze tube. CBD Recover combines CBD with anti-inflammatory compounds like Arnica and vitamin B6 to give you the support you need when it matters most. And to make it even easier to try this amazing duo of topicals and everything else that CBDMD has to offer, they're offering all our listeners 25% off your next order when you use the promo code NBA at checkout. Once again, that's CBDMD.com, but promo code NBA for 25% off your purchase of all superior CBD oil products from CBDMD. I'll be recapping every game in the Orlando bubble, so make sure to subscribe on your favorite app to listen to podcasts, and make sure you always get the latest episode by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. The good and the bad, the ugly are up next. The good, Jay Crowder starting. I know that's the second consecutive game that I've said that about Eric Spoelstra, but I just have to say I am impressed with the fact that not only has he gone with Jay for two consecutive games, one in which I didn't think, he might necessarily be effective. Crowder had a very solid game overall. You love his defense. You love his switchability. You love his ability to stretch the floor. I'm not sure if he could be a better shooter than Myers Leonard, but I think the fact that he's more of a catch-and-shoot type player that doesn't need a lot of room to wind up that shot helps Miami quite a bit. And so I like his insertion in there. Spoelstra has made some tough decisions with his rotation. I am very impressed. I keep reiterating that, but it stands out to me that Eric Spoelstra, who has been somewhat reluctant, inflexible when it comes to rotations in the past, he has been very, very good about doing that in the bubble situation here, and he continues to go with Jay Crowder in the starting lineup. Not sure if that's going to be consistent. I'm not sure if it's going to be on a matchup-to-matchup basis. Derek Jones Jr. and Myers Leonard, two key components of Spo's rotation for most of the regular season, didn't even play today. And that's just... That's really startling, to be honest with you. I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm not sure if you can make anything of it, but the reality is that Eric Spoelstra just finds something that he finds most effective. And look, he's been a little bit more flexible, I think, overall. He recognized that Kendrick Dunn was struggling a little bit, that Duncan was starting a little bit as far as their starters concerned, and went with Goran Dragic and Kelly Olynyk, giving him the opportunity to win. They were, single-handedly, that duo was responsible for Miami's comeback effort to a large degree. And so I think you have to tip your hat to Eric Spoelstra for continuing to find ways to remain flexible and put Miami in the best chance to win. The bad to me is that Duncan is now on the radar. As good as it is for Miami to have Jay Crowder in that starting lineup, Duncan is still Miami's biggest X factor. And if teams are going to find a way to limit what he can do, to double team him, to trap him in places where he can't get that ball on the floor and get past an initial defender. Look, Anunoby and Pascal Siakam are both very good defenders. They're long. They can take up a lot of space. They make it difficult for you to look over them and get a pass, an outlet pass into somebody, or try to dump it off to somebody in the low post. And Duncan just couldn't seem to get any kind of space there. He had a couple open looks, again, as they were trying to key in on other players early on in the game, and those didn't fall, surprisingly, for Duncan. But later on, they just kind of harassed him. They took him out of his element, and I think that's a testament to Toronto's defense and Nick Nurse's coaching, and also a possible game plan for other teams in the bubble. And so, you look at Boston, what they do with Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, very, very solid defenders. They're going to make things difficult for Duncan Robinson as well. And so it's going to be interesting to see how Duncan can continue to get those open looks that has made him so effective, to be able to come off screens. It seemed like he was trapped. He was in an island most of the time where somebody was just limiting what he was doing. I have to rewatch the game, but to be honest with you, I don't remember Duncan doing anything at all during the game. Like, I know he had a couple rebounds and he did have one shot there. I thought maybe that would get him going. It did not. I think it forced Toronto to kind of tighten up their defense and focus on him again. So it's unfortunate to see that teams can take away Robinson, and I'm curious to see how he responds. Post-game, everybody kind of spoke about it, and I think Eric Spoelstra mentioned that he was confident that Duncan would find other ways of making an impact. But, tying into my first good point about the game, I wonder if Eric Spoelstra will eventually say maybe it's time to take Duncan out of the rotation. I can't see that. That seems a little too extreme. I know some people on Twitter were calling for the insertion of Gabe Vincent, and I kind of liked it. I really thought it would be a good fit there because Kendrick Nunn was struggling so much, and Vincent, clearly a good shooter. I wonder if he'd feel comfortable getting thrown into that situation there. He wasn't listed as one of the team's inactives, and so if anything, I think there's a good chance that he could get some minutes there. I thought if there was going to be an opportunity for him to do so, that would have been today. That was not the case. He didn't play. I think Tyler Hero remains an option, too, to potentially start, so something to keep an eye on, because Hero, there was a moment there where Hero just kind of seemed like he was playing at a different level than everybody else. Seemed like he was just really aggressive, looking for a shot, kind of had an FU attitude to him when it came to Toronto's defenders. And he just, maybe sometimes they were over dribbling. Oh, a point I should have brought up in the first segment. Miami in that first half, boy, were they giving up easy looks. Like, they were just passing up shots in two-point range there, or in the mid-range, or even at the rim, just making that extra pass to a three-point shooter from the perimeter. And it started to wear on you, because you just saw it more and more and more, how they were just overpassing in today's game. It was frustrating to watch, because, they were struggling. They were down to the Raptors. They just didn't have any kind of real flow offensively, and yet they were passing up these open looks and they were dishing it out to the three-point shooters who weren't able to knock them down for a variety of reasons. But it was a little frustrating there. And so when you look at what Tyler Herro was able to do, again, just a little bit more confident. He played 25 minutes, finished 5 of 11 from the floor for 12 points. Solid showing from him. And I think he seems to have a little bit of what it takes and just doesn't really back down to anybody. You like that kind of attitude, that grit. I know that that term gets used a lot, particularly with white players. That's a whole other story. But I like Herro's tenacity. Let's use that. He just seemed like he did not give a zero fucks. Sorry to use that language, but that's the reality. He just seemed like he was very, very willing to challenge Toronto's defenders to get his shot or make the right pass. And he looked very engaged. So I wonder if he's an option to start if Kendrick Nunn continues to struggle. And that was particularly glaring. Nunn was just not very good. Defensively, he kept going under screens. If you saw the broadcast or saw the game, you'd know that was the case because Eric Reed and John Crotty both pointing out how often Nunn was going under the screens, giving Fred VanVleet or Lowry open looks from the perimeter. He struggled so much. 0 of 7 from the floor, 0 of 5 from three-point range, finished with 2 free throws for his total of 2 points, 16 minutes in the game, and just horrific. Just bad, bad game for him. And I think that's the ugly aspect of today's game is that Fred VanVleet just finished with 36 points, a career high. But moreover, not only did he score a bunch, and we know that he can shoot well. He finished 7 of 12, which a lot of that, I think, you have to give credit to Nunn's poor defense, giving up those open looks and then allowing VanVleet to get into a very comfortable rhythm. But hell, Fred VanVleet finished 13 of 13 from the line. That is freaking ridiculous. His free throw rate for the season was 3.4. He only went to the line about 3.4 times per game. And somehow he finished with 13 free throws. That's not on the officiating. That's on VanVleet selling contact, getting bad looks. I mean, getting open looks there and then being able to draw a foul as you're recovering, as you're trying to curl around Mark Gasol as he's setting the screen there. That was just really, really ugly. You can't look, if it's one thing that Miami's guards have a problem with the point of attack where they just give up the rim to quicker ball handlers, I just can't imagine what they're going to do. Like, VanVleet's not super, super fast. He's quick enough. He's solid enough. But he's not a Kemba Walker. He's not a guy who's going to blow past you the same way that Walker will. And if that's the case, you're going to get slaughtered when you go up against these faster pick-and-roll type guards. I mean, Kemba Walker kills Miami anyway, especially when they have a solid team around him like he does in Boston. I don't want to see what happens on Tuesday's game if Nunn continues to start and struggle the way he did. I don't know that there's a better option. You could go with Iguodala. You can go with Butler. I think Butler was trying to do a good job, but he had to contain either Lowry or VanVleet, and I think he focused on Lowry more often than not, who finished just 2 of 8 from the floor. So you give Butler his when it comes to the defense that he played. Lowry got 9 of 9 free throws, but a lot of that has to do with, again, him selling the contact. But for VanVleet to get to the line 13 times is just really, really bad. And, you don't really want to make that a habit because you do need to tighten things up. Overall, a good, solid game for the Heat, but there were some issues there. Hopefully, they'll be able to tighten those up against the Boston Celtics. But I'll be answering your questions about Myers Leonard, Kendrick Nunn in the next segment to wrap up my recap. But say it with me now. Sports are back, baby. I've been waiting for this day since March, and now that it's here, I've only got one thing on my mind, and that's my bookie. It's a home run, a slam dunk, a triple overtime game-winning shot all wrapped into one. I love it. You love it. And that should be all you need to hear in order to start betting today. My bookie has up-to-the-minute odds on all your favorite teams, and with the start of Major League Baseball, there's never been a better time to start playing. With my bookie, it's easy. You bet, you win, they pay. If you're feeling good about your team's chances this year, be sure to check out my bookie's World Series future bets. Nothing shows you believe in your squad like betting on them before the season's even begun. But why stop with baseball? Smart bettors are always looking towards the future, and in this case, that means basketball, hockey, football. My bookie's already accepting bets in all your favorite NBA, NHL, and NFL games. Well, we'll see if there's a season there, but there's never been a better time to start exploring the world of online sports betting. Join today, and my bookie will match your deposit 100%. Plus, they'll toss you a free $10 MLB future wager. All you gotta do is enter the promo code LOCKEDONNBA when signing up. And remember, at MyBookie, the terms are simple. You bet, you win, they pay. Just a reminder that you can always reach me via email at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com or on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. On top of everything, despite the comeback win and the good feelings from the loss to the Raptors, Miami is just one game ahead of the Indiana Pacers currently for the fifth seed in the East. Everything's been focused on the Heat somehow catching up to Boston for the third seed, but we've quietly overlooked the fact that TJ Warren, Jimmy Butler's best friend in the bubble, is averaging 42 points over two games, and the Pacers have won both of those contests. Miami's going to focus on winning rather than watching the standings, but things are definitely getting interesting in that regard, so keep looking out for that, especially if you drop the game to Boston or if you drop the game to the Bucks in just a couple days later. Things are going to start to get a little bit tighter for Miami. Look, home court advantage doesn't necessarily mean as much, given that there's no home court. You're all playing on the same team. I don't think fans have, as much as the virtual fans look cool, perhaps, or the kind of crowd noise and the different things like "Let's Go Heat" chants being used, I don't think any of that really matters to players. I think there's been really tight games. It's been really competitive overall, and I think you're going to see a lot of competitive basketball once the playoffs start. But you still want to face a worse team if you can. And I don't know what that team is at the bottom of the Eastern Conference standings. I don't think it's Philadelphia. They have a lot of talent, even if Miami seemed to figure out a way to beat them. The Raptors, obviously, if you can avoid them in the first round somehow, you definitely want to do that. Look, I don't think it's likely that Miami will drop to the seventh seed and face the Toronto Raptors, but it could get a little tricky for them if they have to go up against the Celtics if they're the sixth seed, or if somehow, that's it, basically. They'll either drop to the fourth, fifth, or sixth seed, and if they do, they'll face the Celtics at three for a seven-game series. Not ideal. But what is ideal is getting your questions about every game. Our good friend Claudia, my favorite yoga lady, writes in using the hashtag AskLOHeat. Okay, so what's up with Myers Leonard? Or what's with Myers Leonard? Why is he not playing at all, even off the bench? Claudia, that's a really good question. I know your conspiracy theorists will say that Myers' decision not to stand for the national anthem has something to do with it. I'll just dispel that right away. That has nothing to do with it. I really do think it's based on individual matchups, but I'll say I look at Myers on the sidelines there, and while he's always said he's willing to accept, he's told me about his willingness to accept a bench role or do whatever's necessary or what's asked of him, I feel like it's grating on him. Look, he's also followed up every kind of those statements by saying that as much as he wants to, he's willing to do whatever it takes to contribute to a win, he wants to play. He wants to be out there. He wants to be responsible for good things happening with the team, and he's just not contributing. He's not able to play at all. And so it's a little surprising. I think a lot of that has to do with Olynyk not being as poor as he's been typically defensively and being as good as he's been offensively. What are you getting from Myers Leonard that you haven't been able to get from the combination of Olynyk or Jay Crowder, especially with Bam being able to switch as much from the center position as he has and does? So, I mean, Leonard, he's a big body. I personally like his communication. I love the way that he's able to kind of just keep the defense tight a little bit. But maybe Spoelstra just disregards that and doesn't see that it's very important. Look, there's nothing specific about it. No one's asked Spo, and I don't think anybody else is, why haven't you played Myers? Because I think Spo would probably answer something to the effect, well, he's available and I'll use him when I feel comfortable, but he doesn't like most coaches, like most people, don't like being challenged on their decisions. So I don't know that anybody is really going to bring up why he's not playing Myers Leonard. I haven't seen it. I don't think anybody's going to be willing to ask that. Although, again, now it's been only two games, so there's not like a huge sample size here. But I wonder what the plan is moving forward, because it just seems like Myers has completely fallen out of the lineup, and I'm not sure why. It seems a little weird. Maybe this is Spoelstra's way of getting him to rise up to the challenge, be as competitive as possible. Look, if we look at what Myers did in the playoffs last year with the Portland Trailblazers, he had some of his best games as a professional during the playoffs last year, and Portland wound up going all the way to the Western Conference Finals. I'm not sure if this is a motivational thing. I'm not sure if this is a plan from Spoelstra, or if it's just reading the lineup and saying, you know what, we do better with Jay Crowder out there because he's more switchable. Again, if there was going to be a matchup where Myers could start, it's against Marc Gasol. Gasol is a little slower. You could see that. Not a great ball handler. He never really was, but he's not calling for the ball in the low post. He's just more of a shooter, a perimeter-bound player who can pass and make that entry pass. And Myers would have been able to at least compete with that. So I'm not sure what Spoelstra's thinking, and it just doesn't seem like Myers is going to be playing anytime soon. So I wouldn't expect to see him out there. I'm more surprised that Derrick Jones Jr. has basically fallen out of the lineup. But even though I predicted that going into the bubble, I didn't think it was going to be this stark. It just seems like there's no place for Derrick anymore in the rotation. So that's a little surprising. And I think a lot of that, again, has to do with if he's not contributing offensively, you're not really losing that much by going with Crowder or somebody else defensively. You like what Derrick can do, being able to guard wing players and things of that sort. And maybe this is also just motivation. Maybe, you know, Eric mentioned at the start of all this that he might be making some changes here to kind of keep some things in his back pocket for the playoffs, because you know, the tight nature of the bubble and the fact that other teams can go and visit and watch these games and scout them directly, you have much more time in your hands. You're free of distraction. You're focused on basketball almost 100% while you're there. As much as you can spend time, you know, on the phone with your family and friends and things of that sort, you're really not doing much else other than playing games, getting ready, and that's the reality of life in the bubble. Your days are game on, a game day or a non-game day, and trying to figure out what your schedule is. You're kind of, you know, if you've ever been in a hotel for a long period of time, or if you've kind of crashed at somebody's place for a couple of weeks, you kind of tend to lose time. You kind of lose a sense of where everything is because you're not home. You're not in your comfort zone. And I think that's what we're starting to see here. At the same time, while they do have a different sense of time and place, they're focused on what basketball. They're focused on playing as well as possible. And these are the best athletes in the world. And so you're going to get some really, really good games. And I think we've started to see that more and more. And when it comes to Miami, I think, you know, the fact that he may not be playing Derrick Jones and Myers there could be a way of throwing off other coaches, other teams that scout, and you know, he doesn't want to give them too much information on what they can do with these players. I don't know. It's all very confusing and very surprising. Another question comes in from Yuli, good friend. Yuli, who writes via Twitter, "Very quiet game for our rookies. Do you think they will struggle come playoff time and more teams will be playing defense with a similar intensity as Toronto did today?" Well, as far as the second part of that question, most teams don't play good defense at the same level Toronto did. That's just a reality. Toronto is a very good defensive team. They've got a great defensive player. At the big look, from their center position, they've got Marc Gasol or Serge Ibaka, two really good defenders. You've got really great wing defenders in Anunoby and Pascal Siakam. Kyle Lowry is definitely an all-defensive NBA guard. Van Vliet is not perhaps great, but he is solid defensively. Norm Powell is also solid defensively. They've got a very good team there. You have to give the Raptors credit. I asked Spo about it pregame, what Nick Nurse has been able to accomplish this season with the loss of Kawhi Leonard, and he just had nothing but positive to say about the Raptors. He just talked about they were a team that mirrors Miami in a lot of ways. They develop players, they get the most out of them, they play with chemistry, and I think that's absolutely right. They look like a good, solid team, perhaps even a contender. As far as our rookies are concerned, Yuli, you know, Tyler Herro didn't struggle. I think he's going to continue to rise to the challenge because I think there's a little bit more versatility to his offensive game than what Kendrick does. Look, and we've seen this from Nunn before during the regular season. He'll have a couple games and he'll have a 25-point breakout where his shot is falling if he has a favorable defensive matchup on him. It could happen against the Celtics. Kemba Walker is not a very good defender, so that leaves an opportunity for Nunn to play very well. And Nunn has struggled against Toronto's defense during the regular season too. So look for a bounce back from Nunn where we're kind of all forget what he's capable of doing like he did against the Raptors where he had a really, really bad game. As far as the other rookies, well, there aren't any aside from the young players that don't get any playing time. Perhaps you're trying to include Duncan Robinson in there, and I kind of addressed that already. So I think rookies and young players just tend to have bad games a little bit more frequently as they're trying to figure out their footing there. So I wouldn't be worried about it too much. Again, from the defensive standpoint, not many teams are as good as Toronto is. So I don't think it's going to be a huge issue. And I think Spoelstra has shown enough versatility and flexibility with his lineups to say, you know what, if they do struggle, I'll take him out of the game and find somebody else who can help us win. Coming up later this week, I'll be recapping Tuesday's win over the Celtics. I'm predicting a win, as well as every other game this week. Be sure to subscribe and follow this podcast to get the latest episode of Locked on Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil, thanking you as always for your support.
Wrap it up, B.